It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Kedren Bardwell. We haven't had him on for a while. I'm very excited to have Kedren back on, Department Chair of Political Science, Professor of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola. Kedren, long time no hear from, but great to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Ben.
Megan Goldberg is with us as well, Assistant Professor of American Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. New to this area, new to Cornell College, taking the position left by someone who, an analyst we've had on many times in the past, Hans Hassel. So, Megan, thank you very much for joining us today in our Iowa City studio.
Thank you. I feel like great expectations from Hans, but I'm excited to be here.
Oh, well, we have great politics to analyze here, too. Of course, it's fast and furious and has been for many months. Let's tackle these New Hampshire primary results in just a moment. Later in the hour, I want to get your thoughts on the president's budget plan. What actually is a budget plan that a president puts out when, Congress has the purse strings there? So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the hour. We want to reach out this first half hour to our listeners. Now that the dust has settled a little bit on the Iowa caucuses, what are your thoughts on Iowa's future in the nominating process? What can the party or state do to restore faith in the process that Iowans hold dear? Join us with your thoughts, perhaps a caucus experience that is relevant. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Well, as we've been hearing, Senator Bernie Sanders narrowly winning yesterday's New Hampshire Democratic presidential primary. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who landed in the dead heat finish with Sanders in last week's Iowa caucuses, came in a close second, splitting much of the moderate Democratic vote with Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. Surprise there, her surge to finish third. Senator Warren of Massachusetts finished a distant fourth, and a stinging blow to the former Vice President Biden finishing fifth. Let's hear a little bit of the victor from last night, Bernie Sanders claiming victory in New Hampshire, alluding to winning the most votes in Iowa according to first alignment numbers, and then struck a chord of unity with his Democratic rivals.
And tonight I want to take the opportunity to express my appreciation and respect for all of the Democratic candidates we ran against. Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden. And what I can tell you with absolute certainty, and I know I speak for every one of the Democratic candidates, is that no matter who wins, and we certainly hope it's going to be us, we are going to unite together. We are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
Bernie Sanders last night in New Hampshire. Kedren Bardwell, open it up for us with your takeaways on these results.
Well, I was looking at a couple things last night, and first would be kind of what did turnout do? And it looks actually really, really good in New Hampshire compared to Iowa particularly. Looks like turnout will be about the level it was in 2008 in that highly contested race. So that says good things for New Hampshire, but again, Iowa's turnout was a little lower, and so not as much enthusiasm there. The other worry was that we might come out of New Hampshire with four or five candidates all kind of clumped together in the high teens, maybe one getting over 20%. We didn't have that. So we had out of New Hampshire a pretty clear top three. And I think the biggest surprise here is Warren and Biden. If you'd talked to me 9 months ago and said that Warren Biden would actually come out with no delegates at all in New Hampshire, that would be very surprising. At the time, Biden was the front runner nationally. Warren later took on the lead in some national polls, and she's from a neighboring state. So that's what I take away, is it was a big surprise. And you have these candidates that people expected just months ago to do really well who weren't even in the running.
Yeah, both Warren and Biden, less than 10% of the votes. Zero delegates, as you mentioned. Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg each being earning 9 delegates each. Amy Klobuchar, 6 delegates. Let's go to you, Megan. What are your takeaways? What did you?
I think in a lot of ways, the results were both surprising and not surprising. If you've been following polls the last week, probably not that surprising. People were pretty on track with the later polls in New Hampshire. And we saw Buttigieg had a huge surge in the polls right beforehand. So his, a week ago, he didn't really have that much of a chance in New Hampshire. And that's really changed over the past week. We can talk later about what that maybe means for Iowa. Mm-hmm. But I think that what's really interesting about New Hampshire and with Iowa is the degree to which the media narrative is really going to matter for these candidates, because the Sanders win was close. The popular vote was extremely close. And they're coming out with the same number of delegates. And so I think, the importance of these early states in a lot of ways is momentum. And they're going to have to figure out a way to capitalize on this. And we see all of that, Klobuchar and Buttigieg are really trying to claim victory of some way in New Hampshire.
Right.
And whether that's just sort of focusing on their overperformance. But I agree with Kedren. Turnout was hugely different in New Hampshire than Iowa. I think that's largely because primaries are easier than caucuses, and New Hampshire has an open primary, so you see a lot of independents. And in fact, I think from the exit polls, we saw a lot of participants in this primary who did not vote in the 2016 Democratic primary. And so I think the other sort of thing about New Hampshire to consider was the role of independents, because there were a lot of people who voted in the New Hampshire primary who didn't vote in 2016. A lot of those went to Buttigieg, but I think New Hampshire was maybe sort of a first test case for electability in a lot of ways.
To dovetail with what you just said, who didn't vote in 2008 that voted for Buttigieg? Let's talk about that, because that's an interesting point. But first of all, in his speech, after his second place showing, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg talked about voting blue no matter who, but also sought to set himself apart from his Democratic rivals as something new.
So many of you turned out, diehard Democrats, independents unwilling to stay on the sidelines, and even some newly former Republicans ready to vote for something new. Ready to vote for a politics defined by how many we call in instead of by who we push out. So many of you chose to meet a new era of challenge with a new generation of leadership. So many of you decided that a middle-class mayor and a veteran from the industrial Midwest was the right choice to take on this president, not in spite of that experience, but because of it.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg last night. Let's talk a little bit about Pete Buttigieg appealing to those independent voters, those perhaps moderate Republicans from former years. Kedren, what do you think about that? We hear that from Klobuchar. We hear that from Pete Buttigieg. Do we know that's true?
Well, I think the one thing that stands out, especially if you look at the exit polls for Buttigieg, you're trying to analyze where does he do well, and he actually does fairly well very broadly across the different Democratic coalition groups. He's one that hits 20-25% in most of those areas. And so if you think of the other candidates, Sanders does particularly well with the very liberal set or younger voters. Biden and Klobuchar, to some extent, are relying on voters a little bit older. Amy Klobuchar doing really well among college-educated. But if you look at the Buttigieg exit polls, the one that stood out to me was the folks who said, like, the most important quality of a candidate is they can beat Trump. Mm-hmm. Buttigieg took that group. And as Megan mentioned, the number of independents was really pretty fantastic last night. We had 45%, I think it was, in exit polls of the Democratic primary vote in New Hampshire was independents. And so that's what a semi-open primary does. It allows those folks in the middle or those folks who are not party attached to have an influence on the primary, for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm. Megan, a comment from you on this after we hear also from Amy Klobuchar talking about people in the middle. She final week of campaigning, giving her a surge to a third place finish in New Hampshire. And she used the opportunity to appeal to that middle of the spectrum.
We know in our hearts that in a democracy, it is not about the loudest voice or the biggest bank account. It is about the best idea and about the person who can turn those ideas into action. We know that we cannot win big by trying to outdivide the divider in chief. We know that we win by bringing people with us instead of shutting them out. Donald Trump's worst nightmare is that the people in the middle, the people who have had enough of the name calling and the mudslinging, have someone to vote for in November.
So the people in the middle, Megan, comment.
Yeah, and you know, I think this idea of independents or swing voters has gotten a lot of attention recently, especially there was a Politico article, I think last week at one point, about a forecaster basically saying there are no independent voters, there are no swing voters,
right.
There are independents and they lean partisan.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's true. That's something we know in political science. That's something we've known for a while, that increasingly independents are actually just partisans who maybe aren't willing to say so, but they act partisan, they lean partisan, and if they lean one way, that's how they vote. But I do think that an open or semi-open primary, like in New Hampshire, does allow for some voters who, you know, maybe don't consider themselves part of one party, or they really do, but I don't know, for some reason they like being independents. But I do think what's sort of interesting, and I think we're starting to maybe see this a little bit, is that these lanes we're talking about, like the moderate lane and the progressive lane in the Democratic primary, are largely an artifact of sort of elite commentary in a lot of ways.
Right.
And so I think that I've seen, and Kendra, maybe you have, I don't know if you've seen this too, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we have seen some exit polls showing that there are people, individuals who, you know, maybe Warren was their first choice and Pete is their second. And if that lane theory is true, we shouldn't see people like that. We should see people who are Warren or Bernie, and we should see people who are, you know, Buttigieg or Biden or Klobuchar. And so I think that these lanes might be a little bit of an artifact of the way we think about politics and not necessarily how all voters think. And so I think that developing strategy based on that might be a little short-sighted.
The lane theory, whether it's called that or not, Kedren, do you doubt, perhaps, sow some doubts there as well?
Yeah, I would actually agree with that. I think the problem is there's a number of dynamics going here. Number one, not all American voters are ideologically consistent or kind of work in those lanes the way that people talk about them or analyze them. And so there are other types of factors going on. It could be anything from the candidates' personalities and styles to the 2016 election. And since then, we've really had this revealed establishment versus anti-establishment kind of lane. And that's not really an ideological lane. That may be kind of a new idea versus old idea lane. And so I think there's just a number of overlapping factors that go into voters' decisions. And so it's not as simple. It's not that I'm dismissing ideology, and I don't think most political scientists would, but voters have other considerations.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the surge by Amy Klobuchar, the continued strength of Pete Buttigieg from last week's caucuses, Amy Klobuchar in particular, Megan, where is she drawing her people from when she jumps to nearly 20% and gets 6 delegates in New Hampshire yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, I think she is drawing in some part from Biden's demise in the polls. You know, I think she has tried to position herself as an alternative. You know, whether or not she is sort of using those lane metaphors. But I think she has tried to use some of the language that she thinks is appealing about Biden's message. But I think, and a lot of what I think she can attribute her bump to in some ways, is I think turnout among women was really high in New Hampshire. And that's one place where both Warren and Klobuchar have really emphasized that sort of area recently. And, you know, both of them have sort of played off of each other's gender in the past week or so. We saw it during the debate. We saw it during, I think, Warren's speech last night. She mentioned Senator Klobuchar. So I think that the turnout of women in New Hampshire really helped her as well.
Mm-hmm. And yet Elizabeth Warren not having a great day, not even having a good day yesterday. Less than 10% of the votes cast. Kedren, why did Elizabeth Warren slip?
I'm having a hard time piecing that together. I mean, I observed on the ground here a lot of the Warren supporters. I know a lot of individuals in our own neighborhood and here at the college who were early supporters of her and actually worked on her campaign. She seemed to have a lot of enthusiasm among kind of the folks who were highly politically active and were looking for a candidate who could speak to the issues that they care about and folks who were a little more in the liberal mindset. But yeah, when it came to actually on caucus night and now in New Hampshire, it seems like she's underperformed. And so, yeah, I don't have a magic answer here in terms of why.
Megan, do you have the answer?
Well, no. I wish I did.
An answer?
I think I agree with Kendra on all of that. I mean, her ground operation in Iowa seemed impressive to me. And like Kendra, a lot of people in like Mount Vernon community and at the college were early supporters of Warren as well. I think that is an artifact of the academy a little bit. She has the academic vote in a lot of ways. But I do think that... one thing you have seen a change in her campaign is this shift to the anti-corruption message. And so you mentioned sort of the anti-establishment, establishment lanes. And I think that anti-corruption message, she was sort of trying to get into the anti-establishment, lane, if you will. But I think that there was something maybe that didn't resonate about that message or mm-hmm. that it wasn't new enough or unique enough to her.
Mm-hmm. Let's, before we close out this half hour with Megan Goldberg and Kedrin Bardwell, our political analysts today. Let's listen to at least one or two of the Democrats who have suspended their campaigns after the New Hampshire primary, after disappointing showings in New Hampshire. One was one I see a lot of, seen a lot of yard signs around Iowa for Andrew Yang. A lot of Yang supporters sad today, I imagine. Let's listen to what he had to say to his supporters in New Hampshire announcing this.
You know, I am the math guy, and it is clear tonight from the numbers that we are not going to win this race. I am not someone who wants to accept donations and support in a race that we will not win. And so tonight, I am announcing I am suspending my campaign for president.
We love you, Andrew!
All right, I love you, too. Thank you, New Hampshire.
So, Kedrin, Yang, an unusual candidate, not a politician, former tech entrepreneur, gained a loyal following, Yang bangers, right? So what happened?
He had actually a pretty significant group here on Simpson's campus, but I can tell you what happened in the Iowa caucuses. He just wasn't in our precinct. He was just below that number of people that he needed for viability. So not just in the caucuses, but in all these primaries, if you look at them, most of them have a 15% threshold requirement. And those candidates that are kind of fighting just to get in double digits somewhere, there's just not a path forward or ahead for them. But as I said, he did resonate a lot with younger voters. And I think this idea of kind of nonpartisan problem solving, and especially as it relates to technology and automation and some of the economic challenges of the next generation, I think his ideas really resonated. And he kind of stood by his standby was the UBI or the Universal Basic Income, that mm-hmm. idea of getting people $1,000 a month. And so I think in that way, he was able to cross over some of those ideological lanes. That's an idea that it would appeal to people who are more progressive, whereas his more practical problem-solving side, I think, appealed to some young moderates as well. So, mm-hmm. just not enough to get national traction, and he doesn't have the money of Bloomberg or Steyer to just outlay billions of dollars in the future.
Megan, what do you have for the sad Yang gang out there listening? He has a political future, perhaps.
I think, I saw someone's comment that I hope he remembers that you can be in politics without being president. And he did, I think, bring a lot of issues to the agenda and gave a lot of attention to issues that haven't really seen the light of day yet. So I think he made an important contribution.
Okay. Let's listen to a few words from the other candidate who dropped out, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett.
I think it's fitting for us to end the campaign tonight. But I want to remind you of why I got in this race, why I stayed in this race, and why we have to stay in this fight. I got in this race because I love our country. I love America. I love the idea of democracy. And I want to make sure that our generation passes this democracy intact, at least, and if not in better shape, to the next generation of Americans.
Michael Bennett, less than a percent, in fact, a third of a percent of the vote yesterday in New Hampshire. Megan, your analysis of Michael Bennett, why his campaign never found a footing.
I think that part of it is just the result of an incredibly crowded field. His campaign never really got off the ground. I was just telling my class this morning, right? 6 months ago, we were watching debates with 20 candidates. We talk about the primaries haven't winnowed the field that much yet, but they really have. They've eliminated a lot of candidates. And so I think that, you know, he just didn't quite differentiate himself. And didn't have some of the resources of other candidates to be able to get his game off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Let's circle back. We heard Bernie Sanders there in a clip a few minutes ago talk about unity, calling out the names of his Democratic rivals there in the minute or two that we have left. Talk about what you see. What is your unity forecast, Kedren, for the Democratic candidates? Is it partly cloudy or stormy ahead or clear skies, perhaps?
Yeah, I would say a stormy is what we're looking at. If Sanders does pretty well in these next couple contests, I'm thinking of, and again, you can't predict everything in politics. I mean, I'm recalling back in 2015 to 2016, we were having this discussion about the anti-establishment candidate Trump and, you know, what's his floor and what's his ceiling. And yeah, Everybody thought, well, he has a pretty strong floor, but maybe he's also got a cap. He's got a ceiling that he won't be able to go over. I think Sanders' challenge is just that there's so many in the Democratic establishment and among elected officials who just do not want him to be the nominee. And a lot of the charges are relating even to him not being a registered, mm-hmm. He's caucuses with Democrats, but he's basically an independent socialist. So, I don't want to say there is a ceiling, a cap, and give a number to that. But I think the question, like in 2016, is how quickly the Democratic establishment can coalesce and actually get some of these other candidates out so that the alternative to Sanders becomes clear.
Okay. Megan, a quick word on that. Unity, what's your forecast?
Yeah, I think I would agree with Kedren. I think in the past we've thought that divisive primaries were okay for the future of the party. But 2016 has sort of cast some doubt on that. And I think this the current primary has got us, a lot of us political scientists, quaking in our boots to see what happens with party unity across the board after this.
Okay. Megan, Kedren, keep your boots on, even if you're quaking, or others out there. We'll be back in just a moment with more political analysis from Megan Goldberg of Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College in Indianola. We'd like to have you join our conversation. How about this question? Are you, as an Iowan, willing to give up the caucus process if it meant we could keep our first-in-the-nation status? What can be done to sort of reclaim or undo the damage that was done last week? We'll come back in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer with Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our political scientists on board this week as we pick apart the New Hampshire results, interpret them, and also we want to look at the Iowa caucus aftermath 9 days after the Iowa caucuses, and still not all the dust has settled on that story as well. Before we talk about that, though, I would like to ask the two of you, in what ways do you see the Iowa result, muddled as it was, delayed as it was in coming, influencing what happened in New Hampshire? Kedren, do you see an influence?
Yeah, I think it can be said now pretty fairly that Buttigieg got a pretty good bounce out of Iowa and surprising people in a number of different areas, whether it was his broad support across different types of coalitions or how well he did particularly in the suburbs. And so I think he got a bounce out of it, even though people thought that might be muted a little bit. And I also think, you know, Biden did get hurt underperforming, mm-hmm. and then underperforming again in New Hampshire. So although it was long and drawn out and chaotic in many ways, I think it still did play a role in getting the candidates on board on a certain number of issues, getting their views out there. And also, I think there was still a bounce.
Mm-hmm. Megan?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think and I think even Buttigieg's surge in the polls in New Hampshire was not just more than we expected, you know, the Tuesday or Wednesday after the caucuses, but more than we expected before the caucuses. I know there was one model I was looking at that maybe predicted like a, if he had won, like a 5-point bounce. And we saw something quite a bit bigger than that. And so I think that he, part of that was him early on capturing this narrative that he had won before we really knew anything. And so I think he still got that huge bump. I think that it might have hurt Biden a little less than it could have, you know, because there was all these other things sort of absorbing people's attention. We didn't focus a ton on how poorly Biden really did do in the Iowa caucuses. So I think, you know, the imaginary, you know, had the results come in quickly and there not been recounts and confusion, we might have seen Biden do even worse in New Hampshire, possibly. And we haven't seen them this really hurting him that much in national polls either. So I think Biden was a little insulated from how bad it could have been.
So let's talk about the caucuses, where we stand 9 days after they happened. The Iowa Democratic Party, this was on Sunday, allocated delegates, giving the former South Bend, you know, mayor, Pete Buttigieg, the largest delegate count, closely followed by Bernie Sanders. Said it would award 14 to Buttigieg, 12 to Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, 8 delegates, former Vice President Biden, 6, Amy Klobuchar, 1. Now that, Megan, to you first on that, what happened? I mean, there are a lot of parts. It was a bad app, right? with a name that, wow, how do you pick out Shadow Inc. for your...
Election rigging Inc. was taken. I don't know.
Summarize quickly all the things that went wrong with the Iowa caucuses.
You know, I think, and Kendra, please feel free to interrupt me because this was my first caucus season being here in Iowa. And so my sense is after this that, you know, some of the things that happened this time happened at caucuses in the past. You know, you're doing headcounts in a gym. You know, things can go wrong. You're relying on precinct chairs and they're not highly trained election administrators. That's not what the caucuses are. And so there are bound to be mistakes, but having the paper trail this year and sort of adding a few different new rules, you know, was maybe too big of a step. I often speak in favor of incrementalism, and this was maybe not that. But I also think that part of the results getting delayed meant that we had a bunch of news anchors standing by to report results, so they turned to something else. And then what sort of got highlighted instead was individual precinct sites mishaps.
Right.
So I can tell you, I mean, I think I read half a dozen stories about a site in Marion.
Well, I was on air that night from 7 till midnight, and we were ready to, you know, have analysis of the results. No results. It's like a shark in the water. You need something to eat, right? As a member of the news media,
exactly.
You got your whole team geared up. So you naturally turn, without results, you turn your attention to what is the next story, which is why aren't there any results, right? And then getting those stories from the individual precincts as well. Kedrin, quickly, anything to add to what Megan said there about characterizing what happened last week?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo that. I mean, there were. I was an observer at a caucus. I was leading about 39 Australians on an Iowa caucus tour, so we were having fun that week. But we decided to go to 3 caucuses and split up. And the one that I was at, a lot of the layers that were added, whether it's the specific cards and then the signing on the back or the signing on the front, and the fact that there would be 3 different counts that needed to be tallied, it just layered on, I think, too much potential confusion when you don't have people who are highly trained. And so the funny thing that happened at our precinct, and this was Indianola number 3, is they talked about the total number of people in the room and even the threshold before they took a first alignment vote, which is very out of the ordinary and should not have happened. And so Biden actually had over a dozen people in his circle. But because they had already talked about the total and then the threshold, they knew exactly how many people they needed to have to be viable, and they knew they weren't. And so before even first vote, those Biden supporters almost all moved over to Amy Klobuchar to make her viable. Now, this should have never happened, because if you look at the tally for Indianola 3, it's going to say Biden got 0 on first alignment. But he really didn't have 0. He had over a dozen, but they had essentially preemptively moved over and dissipated to Amy to try to be viable. So because the process took a little while and it got muddled in terms of what was supposed to go first, you had these types of errors.
Wow, that is an interesting anecdote your firsthand experience there, Kedrin. Megan, you have a caucus experience?
Well,
really?
I actually think that we observed something similar at the caucus site I was at. And I actually didn't know that that wasn't usual. that, you know, and coming from, you know, I was talking to campaign precinct captains while I was there. And, you know, they're usually trained ahead of time by the campaigns to be doing that sort of calculation. You know, so I know that the precinct chairs from each campaign, not chairs, captain, sorry, knew the number they needed. But we saw a little bit in our in the precinct I was at, negotiations between a small Steyer camp and a Yang camp even before the first alignment, talking to each other as, you know, voters were coming in and still registering, to see if they could convince the other side to sort of band together to get one viable candidate.
Okay, let's get some input from our listeners as we look to the final 15 minutes of this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, Kedrin Bardwell of Simpson College, Steve in Parkersburg, one of our listeners, says, Iowa voter here, kill the caucus. Ranked choice primary, please. Other thoughts perhaps on the Sanders win in Iowa and, dead heat with Buttigieg in Iowa, the win in New Hampshire. Eric is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Yeah, I was a precinct chair. And when we had our first alignment, we all did the first choice. And then we had several that were unviable. And then, you know, one of those was Bernie's group and one of them was Joe Biden's group. And when they realigned, they went to Pete and Warren, and Bernie became viable at that point in time. But I guess that my comment to your person before was that, you know, I heard Bernie say something about he won the first alignment, and, you know, that may be true, but he didn't win afterwards when all the moderates and went to somebody else. He's not going to draw that crowd.
Eric, thanks very much for your view. Let's go to Tom in Clive. Tom.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. You had some ideas about how to improve the caucuses in Iowa. Should we have them again?
Yes. yes. By the way, I sent you a separate email with a sample ballot that I drafted.
Okay.
But let's put that aside.
All right.
One of the things that's a concern to me is that by having the caucus process, and I've participated in several, eliminates the possibility of people who work in the evenings or who can't get somebody to come home and take care of their kids from participating. And I think that's a mistake. I also would like us to have a more extended hours, ideally having a voting process using the same locations and the same methods of recording votes as we do in the general election. Mm-hmm. In other words, having extended hours.
Right. And both of those. Go ahead quickly, Tom. We've got other callers.
Okay. I just think that the processes of itself is just too cumbersome. Take a look at my suggestion and comment on it. I'll hear your answers on the phone. Thank you again.
Tom and Clive, thank you so much. Of course, a common criticism is the low turnout, the accessibility to the Iowa caucuses. Right, Kedwin, this is something that the Iowa Democratic Party has been trying to remedy with some of the alterations they made this year.
Yeah, and they were trying to think of kind of a virtual caucus location thing, and then that fell through. I worry about the viability, and it's not even Iowa specifically, although certainly we're taking the brunt of this season. I worry about the long-term viability of the caucuses as a part of this nomination process. I just think they have these problems that are well-known and that really get exacerbated when anytime you have higher turnout, it makes it more cumbersome if you've got these different counts that need to be made and delegate calculations. After watching New Hampshire in the primary, it's just so simple. And, you know, the joke reporters were having that night is, you know, we know New Hampshire's results now before we even knew Iowa's from a week ago.
Right. Kedrin, but just point out the idea, because the natural thing then would be to say is, why don't we dump the caucuses if it keeps us in the running there as first in the state? But then New Hampshire would have a problem. New Hampshire would have a problem with that, right?
Yeah, New Hampshire's had a law for over 50 years that essentially says it must be first in the nation, and for the most part, they've actually had almost the same Secretary of State for most of that time as well. And there's been discussion about doing something about the ordering of these first few states because they're not representative, but it really never goes anywhere. Now, that actually makes me a little bit more hopeful that Iowa can retain some spot in the process because there is a little bit of a status quo inertia going on here. You do have to get the DNC and then ideally also the RNC, the Republican and Democratic National Committees at the national level, to agree on what a new system would be. And so whether that's a rotating regional primary or some of these other ideas, the fact that you need to get those parties on board with a similar solution actually, to some extent, protects Iowa, New Hampshire, and the first four states because you have to come to consensus on what would replace it.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit about what the president said about the Iowa caucuses. This is at a Monday night rally in Manchester, New Hampshire. He talked about the inability of the Iowa Democratic Party to determine the winner of the caucuses and struck out at one of the Democrats in particular.
The Democrat Party wants to run your health care, but they can't even run a caucus in Iowa. By the way, it's a week. You know, I turned on at 7 o'clock. I wanted to see who won. They said, there's a little problem. Little did they know. It's now a week. Does anybody know who won Iowa? I don't know. Maybe Rand or Lindsay. Rand, does anybody know who won Iowa? Lindsay, you're a total pro. Nobody knows. He said nobody. Flip a coin. They're going to run your health care. Unbelievable. Nobody knows who won. Actually, I think they're trying to take it away from Bernie again. I think Bernie came in second. Can you believe it? They're doing it to you again, Bernie. We're saving your health care while the socialist Democrats are trying to take away your health care.
Okay, Megan, a lot to take in there, comments from the president Monday night at a rally in Manchester. How effective do you think his message of socialism and taking away health care is against the Democratic field in particular?
You know, I think there's a lot of sort of observers and Democratic Party leaders who are worried about that criticism. You know, I think that Trump has shown in the past that he can find a pretty effective way to mobilize against any opponent. You know, I think Republicans are salivating a little bit at the idea of being able to run against someone who self-identifies with the word socialist anywhere in their label.
Right. And then we have the 2018 elections behind us. We have a lot of moderate Democrats who, including here in Iowa, claimed a seat in Congress. They do not want Democratic Socialist lapel pins on, right? They would be running from those.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
But anyway, I interrupted you.
Yeah. I think that Trump has a strategy in place, and Republicans have a strategy in place if Bernie were the nominee. And I think that it would largely involve sort of really capitalizing on that socialist label.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Bernie's support shows that there is a part of the electorate who does want that. And I think Kedren mentioned earlier that people are largely not ideological voters, but we do know that in a lot of ways people do have there's a lot of support for not necessarily completely socialized programs, but there is a lot of support out there for additional government spending and support.
Mm-hmm. Running out of time. Final 5 minutes. Let's get a caller or two in. Is it in Cedar Falls? Is it Micah?
Yeah, Micah.
Micah, welcome to the program. Not much time. We're sure glad you called in. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to point out that one way that I think the caucuses are flawed that hasn't been getting a lot of conversation is its disparate effect on women, and specifically single mothers or mothers who may have to take their children to the caucuses or just may not be able to caucus at all because they have babies or children with them. And I just think that it's something that needs to be discussed when it comes to, you know, half of the population being able to get their voice out there. And so, yeah, that's just
Micah, thank you very much. A quick comment. I think Megan has a comment for you.
Yeah, you know, Micah, I wanted to say that that really resonates with me a lot. I have two toddlers who I dragged to the caucuses with me, and it was miserable. And, you know, that was the only way that, you know, my spouse and I would have both been able to caucus. So I think, and you're right, that there has been a tradition usually then sort of a disproportionate burden on women to stay home if they're young kids or kids at all. And so I think you're absolutely right. And I do think that some of the campaigns have tried to solve this problem. So Warren's campaign in particular, I know in Iowa City, actually offered childcare services. They were sort of thrown together at the last minute, maybe not perfect. But, you know, that gives me some hope that people are sort of trying to consider solutions for this.
An email from Greg before we finish up the hour. How come the Republican sabotage, writes Greg, of the precinct counting process has not been mentioned? Allegedly, he writes, the GOP voters called the number that Democrats were supposed to use as a backup to report results. This was important when the app failed, right? Kedrin, give us your view on that. Did that happen? Do we know there's a lot of conspiracy now. We had that big void, no right. results, things going wrong, and of course, conspiracies love voids to fill.
They do. Especially when it can be framed as kind of the establishment versus the elites. But no, we do know that there were folks trying to encourage people to use those lines and kind of fill them up. We don't know exactly how extensive it was in terms of the amount of disruption that caused to the call centers. At the same time, those call centers were essentially a backup. Like, they only had to come into play because some of the frontline counting and the app and other things didn't work as well as they should have. So, again, it's just the complexity that goes into handling this kind of count, I think, works against its role in the process. And Iowa's role in the process is now, I think, in some jeopardy because of the difficulty. But it's not just a Democratic thing. We had a 2012 caucus on the Republican side where the numbers also got screwy. So,
right.
I would disagree with the president that this is just a Democratic issue.
Right. And to one degree or another, there's criticisms on the Iowa caucuses, even when things go right, Kedrin. You will testify to that, right? Because there's a lot of people who just do not want Iowa to go first and think it's unfair for some of the reasons we mentioned on this program. But when we think about the coming weeks, Kedrin and Megan, what will you be watching for to read Iowa's fate in terms of will there be another one in 4 years? Are there things that, Kedrin, you'll be keying in on?
A lot of it depends on who the nominee is that comes out of this process and whether that person wins the presidency, because that could change really everything in terms of how things go. So that's definitely something to watch for. The other is whether the focus is entirely on Iowa or whether the caucus process that's used in almost a dozen other states also goes under fire.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Megan? I mean, we have to think of it. We've been with this system of Iowa going first since the 1970s. By chance, it happened, right? Can we even think of another system that would be fairer or better?
Yeah, I think that one thing that's really interesting about the primary process is, it does require some coordination between the Democratic and Republican parties. And so I actually think it's really interesting, as Trump was criticizing the process, actually the Iowa Republican Party sort of came out and they're like, no, we need to make sure that the count is right, and very supportive of the IDP in a lot of ways. And that's because it's in their best interest to really cooperate to make sure we maintain this status. And the state parties, obviously, they have a huge interest in the role they play. So I agree with Kedrin, sort of seeing how caucuses go moving forward in this primary season will be really important.
Well, Nevada's definitely learning from Iowa's mistakes. That coming up in a few days, I think about 10 days, the Nevada caucuses, Nevada Democrats abandoning plans to use Shadow Inc. That was the vendor for this vote reporting app that performed poorly. But they will still, Kedrin, have this more complex tally, initial vote, final vote, and then also delegate numbered. How do you see things running in quickly? I guess I'm looking up at the clock. Not much time, Kedrin. Your final remarks.
I have no idea how Nevada's going to go. I won't. It's funny to think about how much of the order of this process in the first four states is just either happenstance or political intervention. I mean, Nevada is really there because Harry Reid was majority leader of the Senate at the time. I think the rest of the country looks at these first four states and just says, why you? Why not a more representative state? Why not a Pennsylvania or a Colorado or a Virginia?
Okay. Kedrin Bardwell, Department Chair, Political Science, Professor of Political Science at Simpson College in Indianola. Megan Goldberg, Assistant Professor of American Politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Megan and Kedrin, thank you for an enjoyable hour, and thanks for all the input from our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Also help today from Stephanie Nobrega. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.